cash position get moved. All right, so yesterday we left off with what might be a little bit of a contradiction in the versions of Rabbeinu Tam, might not be. Tell me what you think. That on the one hand, there is the implication that the Harkotos of Rabbeinu Tam, which again is a system of distancing somebody who has not given his wife a get, which is advocated particularly in the context where we're not talking about kfiya, that's what it sounds like. So those techniques, it sounds like they are therefore not considered kfiya, and that's why they're acceptable. On the other hand, we saw that some readings of Rabbeinu Tam maintained that they can only be done because the person who is the subject of these techniques could end up going somewhere else. So is that a contradiction? Do we say should it be one way or the other, that either it's not kfiya and that's why it's all right, or it is kfiya and it's only all right because you can escape it? Is that a contradiction? And before answering that question, so maybe think about it this way. If it's not the escape clause that makes it okay, so what else might make it okay, right, in terms of what we've discussed so far? So why might this not be clear? Now, what were some of the possibilities? Really?
We're not doing anything active to...
Okay, we're not hurting him, we're just holding things back. So for the sake of focus, let's work off that interpretation. Okay, let's say that in some places we get the impression, and it's pretty explicit in some of the places, like the Tshuvas B'nei Mezed and others, so it's a good one to use, that this is not considered to be coercive because it's just holding back, it's not doing anything. And yet, we also find other sources that read the same Rabbeinu Tam as saying it's okay because it can escape. So what is it? Is that a contradiction? How could you deal with that? What do you think? Is there a way to make those two sentences coexist? Right?
I mean, the ability to escape means that we're not, maybe it means that we're not actively doing anything to prevent you.
Okay, so, I mean, that prevention itself would be active.
Right.
Right, so that's another interesting question. We haven't actually even got to that. You're dealing with the question specifically of stopping someone, which is itself already the same discussion. But let's say you're not stopping them, there's nowhere else they can go. Right, so let's assume for the sake of simplicity that it's nothing that you're doing, it's just the reality is there's nowhere for him to escape to. So does the requirement of having an escape clause therefore mean that this is kfiya otherwise? And if so, then why are we defining kfiya by positive or negative? Are you following what the issue is? Should I say it again? Here we have two different versions of Rabbeinu Tam focusing on different reasons why it's okay, and it seems like you should only need one, that they're basically contradicting each other. That if kfiya is defined only as something you're doing to somebody and not withholding of privileges, then it should be okay regardless whether or not he can escape the situation. And if the issue is it's not kfiya because he can escape the situation, so then we shouldn't need to focus on whether it's positives or negatives. We could say hitting with a stick is also not kfiya if he could escape. Marty?
You could say that the fact that he can't escape, that itself is something that's considered active on your part, or at least it's less passive.
Well, so I think that's what Ayu was saying a second ago, that stopping him from escaping might be considered something active. But let's say for the sake of this discussion that you're not necessarily stopping him, although that's a part of the question. You know, that's a part of the proposed law we discussed here, that withholding a passport is a method of convincing. But let's say that's not the focus here. The focus is that he can't escape for whatever reason. It's just there is no place for him to go to. Nothing that you're doing that's creating that, but there is no other where he can go where the situation is not going to be relevant. So why would we need to mention both reasons? All right.
This might be a little creative, but if perhaps he can take it down for a while. But if the
creative in a good sense or creative in a bad sense?
Maybe the reason why something is you can't it's kfiya, it's too much kfiya if it's active, mm-hmm. but not if it's passive, is because that creates too much pressure on a person, or it's too much pressure coming from us. So the ability to escape is also not something that comes from us, and therefore that's not a, also not, it lowers the standard of fear. It's not so bad. So maybe passivity means that it's less coming from us, and the ability to escape means it's also not coming from us. He has an ability to escape.
So you need both.
Right.
Well, that is creative, but it's interesting. I mean, tell me if this is what you're saying. You're basically saying that we need essentially whatever pressure he feels to not really be something we're doing to him. So the two elements together both contribute to that. One, that we're not doing anything, it's just withholding. And two, also, that who says he's got to hang out with us? Let him hang out with somebody else. So it's his choice to hang out with us, and it's his choice to care about these positive benefits that we are withholding. That's actually interesting. Rather good creative. But you could also say differently, which is how some suggest and others reject, that you could say that once there's no other option, then withholding your benefits becomes an act of negative. Right? If we say that we're not going to provide any services to you, so that is withholding positives as long as he can get these services somewhere. We assume that some of these services are basic necessities of life, or at least perceived as basic necessities of life. So then, it becomes coercive if there's nowhere in the world for him to get these services. But if we say, listen, Gesunte Hake, get these services from somebody else, we're just not going to be the ones doing them. So then maybe, okay, that's simply withholding. But the very nature of the passive-active definition might be contingent on there being other ways to get it. Now, that once you're saying, listen, there's nowhere in the world you're going to get this service now, and therefore you are condemned to be without it, that becomes essentially hurting you. While if there's somewhere he could do it, it's just not going to be us, so then we are simply separating. Really?
It sounds like what you're pointing is that it's basically, it can be similar to the idea of like how much the degree that we're affecting him. Meaning, the passivity is really supposed to be seen as we're not harming him so much. But if we were in a situation that the passivity would really restrict him, that it would really be a strong degree of how much we're affecting him, how much we're berating him, it would be too much, and therefore he has to have like a second option to leave. It sounds like it's more of a function of degree.
You're saying that basically the degree becomes defined.
Right.
So I think you're right, and I think, you know, all of these points kind of highlight the somewhat subtle nature of this whole discussion, and it's always hard to pinpoint exactly what the key element is. I think you're right that at some point all these factors combine to create a quantitative difference. But it's not necessarily what we have to say here. We could say that here the issue is that let's assume these services become basically necessary. And the coercive part is that you're saying you can't have these necessary services anywhere. But if you can have them somewhere else, but we're not going to be the ones to do it, so then that's not coercive. Now, you're right also that eventually that transfers into a greater intensity and at some point it becomes unbearable. And then, if that's our method of definition, that's also going to be relevant. So it's not certainly not an irrelevant point, but you can say it without that. You can say it without coming out to that. So, there are those who consider that distinction we just mentioned, and there are those who explicitly reject it and say, no, they don't think that that's the issue, but withholding of services is always non-coercive, regardless of what other options people have. Now, there are those who read the Re who's quoted in the Mordechai, in Masechet Shavuos. I'm not sure if I put this on my Makomos, but I'll just mention it briefly, as disagreeing with Rabbeinu Tam. And if Rabbeinu Tam indeed is to be understood as saying withholding positives is not kfiyah, The re is read differently. The re is read to say that even withholding positives is also called onus, is also called against someone's will. However, there are those who suggest that the re and rebbeinu tam could be reconciled. And you could say there's two different types of withholding positives. You can withhold positives that somebody already has, and you can say we're going to take them away from you, or we will not continue to supply that which you already have a history of getting. Or we could say that we're withholding positives you do not yet have. So maybe the re agrees that basically withholding positives is not necessarily kfiya, not necessarily onus, but the positive that a person already has a portion in, so to speak, to deprive him of that, that is called kfiya. What's the difference? What's the distinction between the two? You don't necessarily have to go to psychology and the endowment effect, which I think we spoke about some point this year, I don't remember why, but the psychological studies that have established that people are much more concerned about holding on to what they have already than about getting new things. So you could bring that into the discussion if you want, but the study about the coffee mug, they gave people coffee mugs and asked them how much they would pay to get the coffee mug in the first place, but then once they had the coffee mug, then they tried to figure out how much they would required to be paid in order to give it up, and it was always a higher number. People always have a stronger connection to that which they already have than that which they want.
It came up in, I think, the Gemara, in Ksus, about selling if it's onus, if someone is forced to sell.
Right. That was relatively recently. So, you could invoke that, but even without that, why else might you say that? Why else might you make such a distinction?
The distinction
that somebody, it's called onus or kfiya if somebody loses a privilege that they already have, but not necessarily if they are deprived of one they do not yet have. Danny?
I think maybe you can relate it again to the distinction of the active versus passive actions, because you have to actively go
away.
To someone and take away versus, in the future we're just not going to give you something, we're just going to sit idly by.
Yeah, it does seem to correlate to that to a certain extent, just in terms of whether we're going to focus on your behavior, so to speak, in terms of whether your behavior has to be active or passive. It could also be that it's basically a question of one is considered to be coerced when they are afraid of something. When you're hitting somebody, you're basically saying, I'm going to keep hitting you unless you do what I want, and they're afraid of getting hit. So that's called coercion. So people are afraid of losing what they have. And they're going to panic, and you're going to act defensively not to lose what they have. That's maybe the key word, the defensive reaction. While something they don't have, okay, they may understand that they have to do something to earn something they don't have, but that's not the same type of panic, so to speak. Say, all right, some things they don't have. Some people don't have things, that's just the way it is. And you want to get it, okay, so you'll convince us you deserve to get it. But when somebody already has something, so the thought of losing it, that's perceived as a threat. That's perceived as something people are going to be scared of. And therefore, you could say that's a different level of attitude. Okay, so those are some of the theories that you have there in terms of understanding what exactly is driving rebbeinu tam. Now, further than that, it's also worth noting that, just to make things a little more confusing, that there are those who write the halacha that nowadays we don't do halachas rebbeinu tam. So that throws another monkey wrench into the picture. There is the Maharival, who is quoted as saying this, and a few others, the Shach and the Sefer Gvura Sanoshim. Sorry?
That we don't practice
the Hafakur. Yes, we don't practice the Hafakur. So that, you have to figure out why that should be. Why should that be an appropriate policy? Now, it's not necessarily the Midah, But the idea that there are those who feel that something changed, so why would they take that position? Any suggestions or any theories?
Maybe we've mentioned this before, that if escape is a necessary aspect, there might be, in some senses, no escape nowadays to another place. It's easy to spread the word about a recalcitrant husband.
Well, it's easier now, although, again, you see that it's not even as easy as you think it would be. I mentioned it's a kind of a paradox of the modern era, that on the one hand, you have the internet era, so you can get a message theoretically to the whole world at once. At the same time, there's also enough subdivisions in our culture that there certainly are still places one can run to where people don't care about the message that's being spread. But we're talking about still several hundred years ago before there was a internet. So I don't know if it necessarily goes that far, but what seems to be an issue, Shmuel?
Is there maybe people live in communities where they just don't leave anywhere else? Like, they didn't have the ability to just get up and go to another town?
Okay, if that was true, although it's not clear that that changed, you know, from the time of the time, that people's mobility necessarily changed.
Could it be just the fact that there's no non-governing president?
Ah, so that's itself interesting, although that's not necessarily something that changed during that kufa. But it's an important point also to consider, right? That the idea, and I think there's no question, that that's the issue that most drives our current crisis today in 2014. Right? The fact that we're essentially disconnected from any kind of central authority certainly has a huge impact on how these issues are carried out. So I don't know if it's the answer to this specific question, but there's no question that it's a huge driver in the crisis, and eventually, it's probably in June, we'll get into, in terms of the prenup, why that does, maybe more than any other element, more to address that. Daniel?
Right, also I was thinking that that probably relates a lot to Kriya, but Nidui or Chayran. Nowadays, it's not nearly as severe as it used to be. Let's say, you know, back then, all they had was their shtetl, or whatever it was, you know, their small community. But Chayran was a severe thing. Nowadays, I mean, it's bad, but
so you're bringing up a couple of interesting issues which might be particularly relevant but also might cut in both ways. So let's talk about that, right? So let's focus on what you're mentioning here. So on the one hand, so we've seen that here the Ramah, you know, the Ramah is certainly a very key mocker here, because the Ramah is the one who brings Rabbeinu Tam into discussion. And just parenthetically, just to mention another complexity here before continuing on this point, that here, really the key two authorities probably in this conversation are essentially Rabbeinu Tam. I'm emphasizing the word authority because it's not just the svara, but it's the weight of the authority behind the opinion. So Rabbeinu Tam on the one hand, as the namesake of the Hachalkus Rabbeinu Tam, and the Ramah, because of his place in terms of authoritative psak and putting the Rabbeinu Tam on the table, are probably the two most authoritative makoros that we see here. And a lot of the weight to find in some of the later sources, some who, we mentioned this already, but some who explicitly highlight this point, that some of the weight given to Rabbeinu Tam's position is, yes, because of his stature from the Beli HaRishonim, but also because of the dual element that Rabbeinu Tam was so machmir on not being kofa get, where it's not clearly called for, and he's one of the major disputants with the Rambam on that issue, and yet Rabbeinu Tam himself is the one who allows these techniques, that is particularly compelling to some of the later makoros. The fact that it's Hagufa, that it's Rabbeinu Tam, who's taking away with one hand and giving with another, that's a point that we've mentioned so far. Even a point that later Svarim have emphasized as a support. So that even if there are those who disagree, but the fact that you have Rabbeinu Tam's authority on both sides of the equation here is particularly relevant. So it's also important to note that in terms of practice, that part of the whole complexity is that Rebbeinu Tam, as it sounds like in the Sefer HaYashar, so Rebbeinu Tam does allow the harchakos in the context of Moedas Alai, right? The same Moedas Alai where he argues in the Rambam and says we can't do kofet, but the harchakos he allows. The Ramah, who's the one again now bringing the Rebbeinu Tam into a new era, the Ramah doesn't bring it in that context. The Ramah brings it in the context of situations where there is a chiyuv legarish, as we saw his citation yesterday, and he does not mention it in the context of Moedas Alai. Now, is it possible you have to put the two Ramahs together? Maybe. But we don't know from the Ramah, and there's reason to think that the silence is significant, that the Ramah is not applying it to Moedas Alai. That's a part of the added level of complexity here. And some suggest that Rebbeinu Tam himself, there's too many different versions, and there's a little bit of a steer in Rebbeinu Tam's whether he applies it in Moedas Alai as well. So that's a part of the issue. But just in terms of the question that maybe something generationally changed, so let's focus on what Daniel just said. So what about the comparison to Cherem? So we saw that in the classical sources, so Cherem is, including the Ramah, right? The Ramah and earlier, and the Rishonim as well, that Cherem is too much. Right? Cherem crosses the line into Kfiya, while other things are below the line. So what's the big deal about Cherem? So we've been assuming that Cherem is a big deal because it contains with it a klala to death, and since we believe in the power of klalos and brachos, that there is a significance to that, so therefore that's essential, even though it's only verbal, but the death message is certainly a very negative, pretty wide-ranging concept, which, you know, presumably if you're going to threaten somebody with death with putting a gun to his head, that would be considered coercive, so therefore maybe cherem should be in the same category. But what if we don't really focus on that element so much, and we just say that cherem has certain social implications, and those implications are considered to be severe, and are considered to be wide-ranging, and therefore, however you put your finger on what exactly is the problem, but cherem crosses the line. The social sanction combination that you find in cherem is too much. To put that on a person is basically telling them he has no choice. So if that's the case, so then let's consider Daniel's point from a minute ago. So what if nowadays it doesn't have such an impact, right? So maybe once upon a time, a person who was in a cherem, his life was essentially over, or at least suspended until he dealt with it. And nowadays, because of the diversification of the Jewish community and the dilution of authority that Menachem mentioned, so maybe nowadays cherem doesn't mean the same thing. Right, so should we say that despite the language that you find in the Ramah and the Mordechai and others, that cherem is off limits? So maybe that's not true. Maybe cherem nowadays doesn't have the same weight, and therefore, l'kula, maybe we could invoke cherem because it's not going to hit things the same way. So if that's true, it's a question you have to explore and have to see, but it also opens the door for another kind of thinking that can go the other way. So we could say that maybe that's why some of the later Rishonim are going to be more machmir on this issue. We'll say, okay, in the time of the Mordechai and Rebbeinu Tam, the harchakos that were mentioned did not rise to the level of cherem. And there was a clear hierarchy that was perceived by the rabbi. That would not be considered something which crosses over. But maybe in later generations it is perceived, or in their generations, the Marival and others, it was perceived as indistinguishable from cherem. And that if that's the case, if the social perception has been that this is a cheirem, and the Rishonim already said cheirem is too much. So then, if the line becomes too blurred, so maybe that could be why the Hafakas of Vengatam, some would say, not to engage. So maybe theoretically, doesn't necessarily have to be the widespread opinion, but then maybe that could explain why that is. Yes, sir?
Is it possible to have a time period in which cherem is not considered so socially stressful and impactful, but the harchakos would be, and so therefore cherem would be usable, the harchakos would not be usable?
You know, it would become a semantics question, presumably. Right? We just relabel things. So, you know, whatever it is that we're assuming that this is the key driver, right? Assuming that it's the tolerability of the situation. So whatever is considered to be too much, all-encompassing, would be comparable to the classic cherem, and whatever would be on the other side of things would be more comparable to the classic harchakos d'rabbeinatam, if those are the issues. Okay, so there is also a number of other questions that come up. So a point that you focused on something Shui said the other day, that the question of outright kriya. So just to note, that's also something that's discussed, that the Marishdam, and this is quoted in the Beis Shmuel, I don't know if I put the Beis Shmuel in the Mar Makomos, but you should definitely take a look, because the Beis Shmuel is easily accessible. It's in Ibn Ezra, Kuf Samach Hei, Sivkat Nid Aleph, that he quotes the Marishdam, that there's a difference between that which is explicitly tied into the giving of the get, and that which is not. That which is explicitly tied into the giving of the get, and that which isn't. That if you just make his life miserable, but you don't say what's going to change it, and then he eventually decides to reflect upon his life and realize that maybe if he was more of a decent person here, people would treat him better, so then that's perhaps not going to be kriya. While maybe mentioning things explicitly, that's going to redefine things. So that also really should depend what we're talking about. Because one could argue, and this is a point that the Sefer Gemara points out, that if we're interested in focusing on whether it's explicit or not, so then if you want to say that not explicit helps, so then you could say that even beating them up should be okay as long as it's not explicit. That if you have a bunch of thugs come over to his house every day and knock him silly, but they don't say what he's got to do for it to stop, so then maybe that still would not be clear because it's not linked directly to what's going on. While the other way around, that the other harfakos might still be okay even with explicit mention. That presumably if you're focused on explicit mention, you're basically saying that kfiya with explicit mention is problematic. So if the method you're using is below the threshold of kfiya, so then we wouldn't care necessarily whether it's explicit mention or not. And if it is kfiya, then it could be saved from being considered kfiya by not being explicitly linked. So it would seem to be, as he points out, that you should only need one factor or the other in order to save it from a kfiya problem. There is another whole discussion. Now, what do you think about the following issue? What if you don't necessarily impose whatever tactic you're talking about because you're worried that this tactic may cross the line, but you threaten, say, oh, if you're not going to do this, then we're going to have to do such and such. So is that better or is that worse? What do you think? Is that more theodic or less theodic? Than actually doing it, whatever it is you're doing. Let's say there's a certain tactic which you're going to hold back from doing because you're worried that it's too much. So instead of doing it, you're threatening. So here also there was a machlokas aposkim. So there's a reason to go both directions. What are the reasons? Like that if you believe that the issue is what you're actually doing, so then you could say that, well, a threat is not the thing. And we know also that people don't always follow through with threats. So we could say, listen, you don't have to take that threat seriously. You could ignore it. I'm sure people threaten to kill you all the time and don't follow through. So too, you don't have to pay attention to a threat if you don't want to. And you could say that a threat, by definition, is not nice. Or you could say the opposite, because you could say that whatever services you're withholding, okay, so then let's say that's only passive. But once you're threatening, so you're making it into a negative, this is what we're going to do to you if you don't do this, so then maybe that's worse. And especially in light of what we just said, that the issue of it being correlated specifically to the get gets a little bit trickier, then maybe the threat actually makes it worse. Now, these are very tricky points to figure out how to navigate in the current climate, because they're also just elements that are part of the discussion.
Is it possible to suggest that that a threat is basically like the ultimate, I guess, withholding of pleasure, meaning any other withholding of services, meaning any other service contributes to the quality of his life, but if he's living in constant fear of his life, then he, you know, withholding, you know, services, galom mizeh, withholding the safety from him.
So you're saying therefore it's more.
So therefore it would seem like perhaps it could be argued that's an extreme of withholding the services.
And therefore makes it feel or makes it.
Yeah, makes it certainly whatever withholding positive is.
Makes it negative?
Meaning if you say that withholding positive is a problem, then of course.
Then this is all the more so.
Yeah, all the more so. Can you.
Right, but I think you're right. You're saying that to whatever extent that you say if withholding services is itself a form of kafiya, then threatening maybe. As far as to say, all the more so, because it frames it as the negative, essentially. That it puts it as something somebody's afraid of now. And that itself is a negative force. But that still could maybe be saved by the idea that if people don't take threats so seriously, as the Gemara sometimes says, of an inish, the gaza below of it, sometimes a person speaks dramatically and doesn't actually do what he's saying. So then that might still mitigate that one. But the essence of the threat could still have that connotation. I always thought it's interesting in general that in English, you know, somebody says, well, he threatened me, so that always carries a certain power, even though the threat could be for anything. So you don't necessarily know what the threat is. He threatened to kill me, he threatened to not talk to me anymore, he threatened not to go out to lunch with me. You know, so some of these things are crimes, and some of these things are not, and some of them are just passive. Or you say, you know, I threatened to quit. So, okay, so that's not a crime. You know, so it's just the word threatened by itself carries a certain emotional weight that it doesn't, people tend to pay less attention to whatever comes next. Oh, you threatened me, I can't believe it, you threatened me, that's terrible. So it's just interesting from a psychological perspective how there is a certain weight to the very act of threatening, which almost overshadows whatever it is that you're actually threatening somebody with. Okay, so now to go back a little bit, just interest of time, to what he focuses on here. So to look a little bit at the end of this minor here. So what are the Gidrei Onus then, according to Rabbeinu Tam, based on the Maharik, which the Maharik might be the most authoritative version. So just to go back to the Sefer Gamus here for a moment. It says, Afshol chachnum divrei arivash lechav eirav. The sphere related, the Afnias Tova Achas, and the Ikovitsi, the Onus, and whatever Leichet Zolah, says that even holding back one thing theoretically could be Onus if it's something that creates too intense pressure. That there are some Rishonim who will see it like that. However, it seems like Rabbeinu Tam does not say like that, because Rabbeinu Tam wrote explicitly in Sefer Yashar that holding back positives is not Onus. And even if the view of Maharik and Rabbeinu Tam, you could still say that Minyas Tova Achas Eino Ones Tadav Shoshim Is Kolach Alkos Yachter Have the Ones Mishum Bidami Lenidui. So here's another important point that maybe it depends just how many things you are doing together, because holding back any one thing maybe is still just simply holding back a service, but when it's too many things at once, so then that's an Ones. Why? Because like we discussed a few minutes ago. The Domilin Idoi, that maybe there's a certain threshold when it becomes comparable enough to excommunication. However, if you're going to say this, so then you have to ask, how does the Rivash leave out the Rabbeinu Tam that disagrees with him, and they should quote him and argue with him? since here all the other Rishonim, like the Mordechai and the Gosa Shri, quote him, so they definitely are aware of it. So therefore, you have to say, he writes here, that the a version of the Rivash, in the words of Rabbeinu Tam that they have, is like the Marik. And they figure that the position is, Rabbeinu Tam holds, one, that Minias Tova is an Ones, when it is particularly oppressive. And the very fact that it's simply upholding, withholding of positive does not necessarily define the circumstances. But specifically when you do all of them together. Because if you're going to say that holding back one tova is not considered to be an onus, so that's to say that that kind of pa'ula, that kind of action, is not called kfiyah. And there's no person here who's forcing you to give the get. So if you're going to say that, so then what difference does it make whether it's one hachak or many hachakas? Because even if you do all the hachakas together, still there's no one person who's forcing you. If you say it's simple positive and negative, then it shouldn't necessarily matter how much the cumulative effect is. It's still basically his decision to do it. There's no person who's doing the actual compelling. And therefore, you have to say that the Rivash and those who agree with him, so they understand that Rabbeinu Tam's position, only redeeming all the harchakos, but Rabbeinu Tam is not counting up all the situations where Minyas Tova is kfir. Rather, he's coming to say that it's permissible to do all the harchakos. It's possible for him to escape, so then you can do all the harchakos. And it's only from being medayik in his words that one could get the impression that if you cannot go anywhere else, then all the harchakos together constitute onus. But we don't necessarily know that any one harchaka is going to create such a situation. Okay. So let's skip a little bit. So now he considers the question towards the end that, so what difference does it make then, or how do we assess if it's partial or complete? And he says as follows. He says, even if it's clear that there are times when you can do the harchakos, such as when a person can go to somewhere else, or when the harchakos are not so pressurizing, such as also when you don't say explicitly that the harchakos are there in order to get the get. So still we have to figure out how does this affect the parameters that the Israeli law involves, which you started off talking about at the beginning. So he says as follows, Dino Zeshel Amarik, Kishiyoko Lachas Mokamato, Eno Nechshel Onas. So the idea the Marik has that when you go somewhere else, it's not, if you can go somewhere else, it's not considered to be an onus. So Yechola Zat Tzuliyah B'Shnei Teranim. This possibility is dependent on two conditions. One, Shemitzideinu Lo Nakvenu Melechas Kirtzon L'Makom Acher, the point that we mentioned before, that from our side, we're not the one stopping him. Hashem Yishaf Mitzido Yesh Lo Tzkol Yechola Esfah Epsharios Elechim L'Makom Acher Afim Lo Nakvenu. And the second is the possibility, as we mentioned before, in terms of Ari's point. One question is, are we stopping him from going somewhere else? Second question is he able to get anywhere else, even if it's not us stopping him? And the point being, Kinei la'avor di rabos medina mi'early ir yesh v'shar shol kalada. Right, so to change apartments in the same country from one city to the next, so everyone can do that. V'adavar shchiach ma'od shanashim v'ovrim atikim birasim makam v'makam v'yesh. Most people can figure out how to move relatively nearby. Move from one city to the next. Most people have the capacity to do that. To go from one country to the next, that's expensive. It's not so easy to do. And to find a living in some other place is also not so easy. So it's not so pashut that any person has the ability to uproot himself and go to another country. And there are many people who, for that reason, they don't have the ability to go to a different country. And all the more so to move their entire residence from there with all the expenses that are involved. And if that's the case, Al Kain ain't kol mashmos tzad iku v'tzia b'ofen zeh. So then, if you're going to say that we're not going to let them leave the country, so that's not necessarily relevant anymore. Somebody is not in a position where he could really afford to move anyway. So if we're going to tell him that he can't leave the country, we're not really doing anything to him. And therefore, this person might be somebody who cannot go somewhere else. And therefore, if we're going to do the harfakos to this person, so then you talking shame together kfiya kenego, that might be considered a pressure against him. Because practically speaking, he can't run away anywhere and save himself from this. And even Rabbeinu Tam, even though he wrote that if he can go somewhere else, then it's not called kfiya. It could be that Rabbeinu Tam was talking about the possibility to go from one city to the next, which everyone can do. But if the rules here, if the policies here are such that they're going to apply to all the cities in Israel, let's say, so then he's not going to be able to be saved from them because, practically speaking, it's impossible for him to leave Israel, and everything in Israel is going to have the same rule. So then the only option he's going to have is to somehow escape to Chutz La'aretz, and if that's not possible, so then we have to worry about fear. So now we quote Shabbavaji Yosef. And Ibn Ezra Bi Omer Chelakas Ibn Ezra Chafei, who quotes at length the view of the Achronim, who wrote that one should do the Harchakos Shabbeinu Tam against the view of the Maribal, and that's how he concludes practically. Right? You may recall also the last topic of Moshe Alai, we also saw that Vaji Yosef was strongly in favor of figuring out some way with Moshe Alai when it's connected with other factors to be kofet. So here he's strongly in favor of the harfakos. But if you look over there, he wrote shapsak dizanita and bishnas tavshin and hey, kasher shomtni kavos chadash or balsa. Now this was written 10 years before this new law. But move on in psak dizanisiachet chukah chadash or harfakos and mekorius to benetam. So this is not talking about the Israeli law specifically. This is talking about the original. Which are done in the place where the husband lives. And therefore they can be done because possible to move. But with the new rules here, they're going to apply in every city in our country. And there's no possibility for him to move from one city to the next. And he assumes that that would be considered free according to everybody, according to Rabbeinu Tam. Everybody in Rabbeinu Tam. Barak and Mikra Shisha of Sharif and Brook, because that was a chutzlar, so Kushim Yuchad, he can't get another code Kfiya. The only way to escape from Kfiya is if there's some way that he can reasonably get himself to chutzlar. So if we're in a situation where somebody can escape the Chutz La'aretz, so so it's practically very difficult to do the harfakos, or you can't get any benefit from them. So if you're going to do the harfakos against him, and you leave him, and you keep him from leaving, so then it's impossible for him to go, so then it is kfiya. If you're going to give him the, if you're going to cancel this prevention of him from leaving, so if they still continue then to make his life limited in the Chutz La'aretz, so again you have a situation where you can't really escape them. That's also a factor that he concludes here. So the one. There's one element of him not being able to escape is going to keep coming back and back in his formulation here. So based on this, taking all these points into consideration, so what does he conclude? And it's not necessarily the only way to see things, but just to within the framework of how he presents it. So he quotes here the conclusions lahalacha. So he says, according to Rabbi Yitam, was quoted with Dr. Moshe and Ramah, based on the version of Ma'arik. So kol harchakos nechshavos l'kfiyek shen loftas alabal, that harchakos are considered kfiyek when they create undue pressure on the baal. K'mokein af harchaka achas bovad nechshavos l'kfiyek v'midav alochetzes moro alabal. And so to any one harchaka, if it creates overwhelming pressure, so that's also going to be considered kfiyek. That was one of the possibilities we saw. K'shiyesh l'baal of sharus alachas k'mokel achar, when it's possible for the husband to go somewhere else, when in that place then there's no pull to the harfakos, so then even in the place where he's in, that's not called kfiyah. Even a place where he can't go somewhere else, but if you don't say specifically, explicitly, that this is the purpose of the harfakos, you just do it stam. So then, and he doesn't really know that that's the explicit purpose, so it's also not called kfiyah. In a place where the harfakos are considered to be undue pressure, so then even threatening to do them, when the person doing the threatening has the ability to fulfill his threat, so then that threat will be called onus, in his understanding. And therefore, one is not able to do all of the different conditions of the law that are proposed, can't do them all together. Then suggests that even in the then rules, that even in the situations where you don't do the prevention of leaving Eretz Yisrael, still there are times when you can't do the other things, such as the situation where it's not going to be practically possible for him to leave, and you do all the other things, because then basically it's going to have that same condition, you can't escape them. But if it is possible for him to leave without unreasonable difficulty, and you don't prevent him from leaving, so then you can do the other things, not counting the prevention of leaving. The mikra showed siu k'neged ha'baal tzav yiku v'tziya bovad, well also a sharafat, those who all you did is prevent him from leaving and didn't do the other things, and a baal ne'elach, let's say, spiduchifus l'chutzar, t'machnas yilutzos, and those things, again, natural wellness. If all you did was prevent him from leaving, and that that is particularly relevant to him because he has a great need to leave, so then that's also going to be considered honest. If you did all the hachakos, but you didn't say that their purpose is in order to force him to give a get, he just did it by itself, v'abal miyuz maso nasinus a get, and the husband on his own realizes he should give a get, u'bikesh mehen shetmuras matan a get yasura mi all of us hachakos, and he requests that because he's giving a get, the harfakos should be removed, both in zeh get kasher. So then the get will be kasher in such a case. But med dvar mamur, what are we talking about? Harfakos tibetam humuskaros pedibra v'sein harishonim. In terms of those harfakos that Rishonim mentioned. Achutziva akbala humuskaron b'chok, but he thinks the certain limitations that you find in the law, Acham lo amel mefarshim teras and mitzvim elu hi avar matan aget, even if you don't say explicitly what they're for, so then it's still considered to be an ones. Mishum shekayom adav mefursim yedu l'kol shachok zeh nefek l'alz l'bailim sheet neget l'shul sein, because that's the whole purpose of the law in the first place. Everyone understands that. B'kal b'chomer shachok mechayi v'slat edin lo di l'bal sh'im matan haget p'teilo is called balo shli biluhu, that with the get, all of this goes away, the bezin has to inform that. So in that form, he thinks that the law then creates onus, assuming that all those other conditions are in place. Now, are there other approaches and other elements to deal with? So we'll have to see more about that, and make God willing tomorrow, even though we're doing a parsha tomorrow, we'll also just add a few more words in order to transition and see what other perspectives we could possibly take. But just to recap the issues that we spoke about today, so we considered the question of do we understand the issue to be the withholding of services rather than the fact that he can escape? So how can we find both invoked in Rabbeinu Tam? and we discussed the possibility that maybe even withholding services becomes something active if he has nowhere else to go. So some would consider that possibility and rejected it and said either way it's still just withholding positive, it's not considered to be negative. And we saw a possible distinction mentioned in terms of Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri as to is there a difference between a service that one already has and the service that one hopes to get. We also saw a discussion of whether or not the Ramah agrees that this is applied to situations of Moed Salai. We also saw a discussion of is there a reason to say, like some say, that nowadays things have changed. So we got into a whole discussion of what is the issue with Cherem, why is Cherem too much, and could things change, either could Cherem become less, or could Hachakas or Benetan become more. And then we got into the discussion of what if it's too qualitatively strong, any one hakaka, does that change things? And then also the discussion of whether or not there's a problem of specifically connecting it with the get, and how there also the issue is, if it's kfiya, so then maybe it becomes kfiya specifically only when it's connected to the get, but if it's not connected to the get, even then other things that were otherwise in kfiya might be okay. That was possibly also. We discussed threatening, how threatening can go in both directions. Threatening on the one hand can be considered nothing, on the other hand, very active threatening could make something be defined as a negative action. And then we saw how the Sefer addressed the parameters of the law, and that we'll look at that tomorrow together. All right, thank you.